This edition of The Point was recorded. We're not taking phone calls this hour.
Welcome back to The Point. In this next segment, we're going to talk about the new book, Attack on Orleans, the World War I submarine raid on Cape Cod. The book tells the little-known and largely forgotten story of a July day in 1918 when a German submarine attacked a tugboat and four barges off the coast of Nauset Beach in Orleans. The book's author is Jake Klim. He was born and raised on Cape Cod and now lives in Bethesda, Maryland, and works as a television writer and producer. He joins us today in our Woods Hole studio. Good morning, Jake.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And I have to say, this is an intriguing story, and it's kind of amazing because it's really a pivotal piece of Cape Cod history, especially now with the anniversary of World War I. But it really doesn't get anywhere near the publicity as do other historical aspects of the Cape. It's just pretty amazing. And I want to ask you first, if you could just set the scene for us a little, tell us what was going on at that time as we neared the end of World War I.
Yeah, it was the summer of 1918. It was the last summer of the First World War. It wasn't winding down per se yet, but we had been at war. Our troops had been over in Europe for about a year. And Germany was at the forefront of submarine technology. And they had U-boats prowling off the coast of Europe in the English Channel, off the Iberian Peninsula, sinking Allied and neutral ships. But they were able to produce a few types of submarines. I call them super submarines in the book, which had the capability of traveling great distances from their home base. And two of these submarines came over to the Western Atlantic in the summer of 1918. One came in June, which was the U-151, and the second was the U-156, and that came 1 month later. And essentially what happened was the super submarines came out of nowhere and made a mockery of the U.S. Navy, and they really brought the war close to home. And there was one day in June of 1918 where there were approximately 450 men, women, and children adrift in lifeboats off the coast of the Mid-Atlantic. And as you can imagine, that raised a lot of eyebrows, both with the press and the general public.
Wow. Wow. Now the Germans built around 400 submarines all told in World War I, right? But there were only these seven that were capable. And these were capable of coming all the way across, like, as you said, across the Atlantic from Germany to the Atlantic coast. So we had never experienced anything like this. This must have been a complete shock for the Navy and just to see these things.
Yeah, this is the first war where submarines really had an impact. I mean, we had there were submarine, prototypes in the Civil War, but they didn't have any, impact like they did in World War I.
Mm-hmm. So we weren't working on anything. Our Navy wasn't working on anything in any way similar to this at the same time as the Germans, right?
The Germans seemed to be, just better at this. They were at the forefront of this technology.
Right. Now, preceding the attack on Orleans on July 19th, I think it was just a couple of days before the attack on Orleans, the U-156 that you mentioned sank the USS San Diego, and this was one of the prize warships of the naval fleet. Tell me what happened there.
Yeah, so the U-156, submerged off the coast of Fire Island, Long Island, and we don't know if it was a mine. We think there were it was a mine that sunk the San Diego, but the San Diego struck this mine, and it sunk within, I think it was 28 minutes it took for the whole vessel to sink, and it was one of the our attaché to the U.S. Navy in London called it one of the only real loss to the super submarines in the Western Atlantic. And, of course, this is the second super submarine that had come over here, and we want to figure out where the heck this thing's going to pop up next. And, of course, it's a big scramble. They sent out, every ship that could sail and every plane that could fly to hunt this, this thing down. But it's hard to find a submarine, as you can imagine. It just disappears underneath the surface. And where it would pop up again was anyone's guess. But, of course, as we know in the book, it pops up 2 days later off the coast of Cape Cod, Massachusetts, just 3 miles off the coast.
Mm-hmm.
So the San Diego was sunk 10 miles off the coast. Now it's 3 miles off the U.S. coast.
Wow. And the San Diego, I know you have a picture of it in your book there. It was a beautiful vessel.
Yeah.
I can see,
yeah.
Just how big was it about?
I don't know specifically how large it was. It was a significant warship, though.
Right. So, So then we're at the morning of July 21st, 1918, and we have the scene off of Nauset Beach. The tugboat Perth Amboy was making its way down the Atlantic shoreline of the Cape with four barges in tow. And one of the things I wanted to ask you was that by 1918, you know, the Cape Cod Canal had already been operational for 4 years. So why didn't the tug and why didn't the owners of the tug just instruct it to shorten its trip and come through the canal?
That's right. And the 100th anniversary of the Cape Cod Canal opening was, you know, this past this week, this month. And that was, you know, had they had the tugboat and the barges gone through the canal, this never would have happened potentially. The reason they didn't was because the Cape Cod Canal had a toll, and the management wasn't interested in paying the fee. And the canal was new; it was 4 years old, and for hundreds of years, ships had been, you know, schooners and wooden ships alike had been sailing the outer arm of Cape Cod, not without problems, as we know. There's plenty of shipwrecks out there, but it was something that, you know, had been done before. So, you know, why break it if it's, you know, why fix it if it's not broken?
So they figured that it was more worth it to them to just take the extra time.
Cheaper.
So what was the toll at that?
I think I did a lot of research to try to find out what the toll was, and I could not. I think it might have depended on what the ships were and how much cargo they were carrying.
I was just trying to get a sense for how that would translate in today's dollars, and whether it was really prohibitive, or whether I suppose it was, if the people were willing to take the long way around as opposed to.
And I know the canal wasn't dredged as deep as it was shortly after the attack on Orleans as well. They weren't.
Right. This would have been before the Army Corps took it over, I guess.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you're right. It had some issues, major issues when it was first constructed. So that could have also been a problem. So, okay. So the tug and its four barges did not go through the canal. They decided to take the long way around, like many boats have been doing for years, and just come all the way down the backside of the Cape, as they call it. So we're off Nauset Beach, and all of a sudden this mammoth black sub, and I understand that some people mistook it for a large whale. Does that say it sort of rose out of the water of Nauset Beach on this very hot morning when this tug was coming down? So walk us through what happened then.
It was a very, very hot and hazy day. One of those days where there's no waves. It's just hot as hell and it's a little hazy. You can't see everything. And if you can imagine, you know, if you're an Orleanian in 1918, you've never seen a submarine before. You don't know what this is that breaks the surface. And this big object just kind of submerged. Popped out of the sea. And at first, you know, people were sort of taken aback, but I think they quickly realized that what this was, because just before 10:30 that morning, shells or torpedoes struck the Perth Amboy.
Wow! Wow! So had now by this time, Cape Cod was beginning, I guess, to come into its own as a resort area. So there were probably people at that point that had cottages on the beach and that sort of thing, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Do these folks? Do you think that they had an awareness of things like the San Diego sinking at that time, or I'm trying to think of what they would have thought when they saw this big black object, if they would have known right away that it was a sub? Or
most of them knew fairly quickly it was a German submarine. I think there was, you know, some hesitation at first that maybe it's an American submarine doing some sort of drill, but quickly people came to the understanding that it was in fact a German U-boat.
Okay, and so the U-boat rises out of the water, the tug is there, and it just starts firing away?
Right at 10:30, the Perth Amboy's hit with the barrage of shells from the two 5.9-inch deck guns on the U-156. It's not sunk. It's pockmarked pretty good. But for some reason, much to the chagrin of the sea pirates, they can't sink the Perth Amboy, so they sort of moved down the line and they started attacking the next barge, the first barge right behind the Perth Amboy. And they go after that and then they move down the line until all four of them are either sinking or sunk.
Right.
And at that same time, you know, the sailors aboard the tug and barges are trying to beat feet and get to the coast as fast as they can in their respective lifeboats.
Right. Now, here's a question. I just want to stop for a minute and ask the big sort of elephant in the room question, why attack a tugboat towing four barges? It would seem to be a kind of a useless target for a U-boat.
And it's said that the German Navy spent more money on shells that day and potentially torpedoes than they did than the barges were worth and the damage they inflicted wow. On the Perth Amboy. But yeah, you're right. That is the million-dollar question. We don't know why. We can only surmise. And, you know, my thinking is that if you're in the middle of the ocean in a U-boat and you pop out of the water and you see anything at all, you want to probably attack it. And, you know, they were sinking, as I mentioned, allied and neutral ships alike, you know, with caches full of halibut, fish, anything that they could find. So really any target, I think, was better than
acceptable.
No target.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they might have thought this was a bigger boat because I mentioned that the day was very hazy and a little foggy. So perhaps in that mid-morning haze, they thought this was a more significant mm-hmm. boat. Maybe they... You know, with the barges towing behind the tugboat, perhaps it looked as if it was one large ship, one giant ship.
Okay, and I'm trying to envision the scene now, sort of logistically, sort of how they were assembled. So you had the U-boat was out beyond the barge and or the tugboat and the barges, so that way when it fired, some of the shells that overshot would then come to the beach. Is that how it happened?
That's correct. So if you can imagine the arm of Cape Cod and the elbow of Cape Cod specifically, the Perth Amboy was going south and towing four barges, and just to the east of the tugboat and barges was the U-156. And you're right, some of the shells that were fired skipped across the water or outright went right over the barge and landed on American shores, which of course makes this event significant. It was the only time during the entire World War that we were hit by enemy fire.
And the first time since the War of 1812, right? About
yeah,
100 years?
Some historians, you know, disagree on this. Some say 1812. Others suggest the 1840s when we were at war with Mexico.
Okay. Okay, so when the shells hit the beach, did they explode? I mean, give me a sense of how many people were hurt. I know we had the two. Was it the captain on the Perth Amboy, and we had two injuries, rather bad injuries on that.
The helmsman who was manning the wheel of the Perth Amboy when the shelling began, the pilot house that he was in actually collapsed on top of him, so he was hurt
wow.
really, really bad. And the captain of that vessel, you know, later said shortly thereafter that he noticed a hole through his arm about the size of a half dollar. So he was injured pretty significantly. And as you can imagine, he's 3 miles from shore. So he needed to get to the shore fairly quickly.
Wow. And how did he get to the shore? How did they get him off?
So on the beach was the Coast Guard station, station number 40, and it was manned by lifesavers. And these guys were essentially lifeguards on steroids. They rowed out in the direction of vessels in distress for, you know, 100 years before this attack even happened, in the attempt to rescue sailors aboard those vessels. And so at 10:40, just 10 minutes after the shelling began, they went out there. They started fast for the Perth Amboy. Of course, there's five vessels. There's only, you know, one of them. They went to the Perth Amboy first, and they met their lifeboat about two-thirds of the way out, and they started administering first aid.
Wow. And I know that, of course, these were the life-saving service guys who,
exactly.
as you said, were well versed in this kind of thing because of all the ships that would come down and the treacherousness, of the coast and how many wrecks there were. And so, yeah, that I can well imagine that was the case. And both of those men survived, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. Now, were there any other injuries on shore?
There were no other injuries on shore. One of the captains of one of the barges was injured by, you know, flying shrapnel and debris when the U-156 turned its guns on that specific barge.
Okay. Now, another question. I'm wondering, if I'm right, that three of the barges actually sank, but one did not,
That's correct?
Correct. Now, was there any sort of a drag that was happening on the Perth Amboy as these barges were sinking? You'd think that they would begin to kind of drag that ship down.
The Perth Amboy was a very sturdy ship. I mean,
sounds as though
it was still afloat. I mean, it was smoldering, it was glowing well into that night from the fire of the pilot house, but it remained afloat. And the next day it was towed to Vineyard Haven. And
wow.
The islanders in Vineyard Haven, you know, gave it a very patriotic cheer when it entered the harbor. And it was actually repaired and under the Lend-Lease Act of World War II, it participated in the evacuation of Dunkirk. So, again, much of the German chagrin, it was still there. And I believe now, later on, it was sunk eventually, and it's now in the English Channel. But the three barges, as you mentioned, did sink, and they are still there, and they're frequented by scuba divers today.
Wow.
Right off the beach.
Well, the Perth Amboy, I guess it says a lot for the general sturdiness of tugboats in a way. What about the fourth barge?
That was rescued. So it was brought up. It was clipped onto the end of the Perth Amboy, so they were able to salvage it.
Wow. Now, the shells that exploded on the... How many shells were fired that day, all told?
We know... records suggest about 147 were fired during the 90-minute attack, which is a lot. If you do the math, that's more than one a minute, I believe. Math isn't my strong suit, but we don't know exactly how many landed on shore. We know at least one, perhaps two, potentially as many as six. And in the book, I've created a map where people suggest these different shells landed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a gentleman who was shingling his house, and he said one of the shells went over his head. There's another woman who was working in her kitchen, and she heard one of the shells land, and saw one of the shells land in the pond right outside of her house. So,
wow. Well, that was going to be my next question. All of these shells that landed on the beach, they didn't all necessarily explode, right?
No, that's correct.
Did
some of them are buried in the muck where they...
That's what I was wondering. So there could potentially still be some of these things out there today? Or
That's true. After the night after the attack on Orleans, the beach, Nassau Beach, was filled with beachcombers, you know, people who go to the shore after...
That's what they would do.
And they one gentleman said that night, almost everyone in town had a piece of shell. Because they knew the historical significance of the attack. And there might still be shells there. After the attack, there was another gentleman who wanted to petition the U.S. Navy to dig up one of the shells from one of the marshes and create a memorial in town. But the Navy didn't want to do that for some reason. Unfortunately, we could have had that as a memorial today.
Wow. Wow. By the way, who were the two, do you have the names of the helmsman and the captain of the
John Bogovich was the helmsman who was injured the most severely, and John Zitz was the second gentleman who was injured on the Perth Amboy, and they were both Austrian by ethnicity.
Wow,
which caused a little bit of.
I was going to say that must have caused it. Now they were, as I understand it, they were brought eventually to Boston for treatment.
Yep, they were brought. They were brought off the boat. I'm sorry, off the barge and off the tugboat, and they were given first aid on the lifeboat on its way to shore. And then one of the doctors on the beach began to administer first aid in his office. But there's only so much a doctor can do for someone who's been injured by a German shell. So he sends him in the train all the way to Mass General Hospital in Boston. So that night, he and his cohort arrive in Boston, and they are basically attacked by the press when they get to the hospital.
Because of the association that they might have somehow been...
And they also want to kind of dig up some juicy details about the attack.
At that time,
Boston's 90 miles, from Orleans, and at that time it was hard for... it was a long trip for the newsmen to make.
Yeah.
But they were making it that night.
You're listening to The Point. I'm Brian Morris, and we're talking today about the new book, Attack on Orleans, the World War I Submarine Raid on Cape Cod. And we're talking with the author, Jake Klim, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to The Point. We're talking today with Jake Klim. He's the author of the new book, Attack on Orleans, the World War I Submarine Raid on Cape Cod. This book tells the story of the July day in 1918 when a German submarine attacked a tugboat and four barges off the coast of Nauset Beach in Orleans. And Jake, this really is an incredible story. So this life-saving station that we talked about that was right on Nauset Beach, number 40, one of a network of these stations that they had along the coast at that time, it sat on a bluff above Nauset Beach, and it was commanded by Robert F. Pierce. And so he took the lead role, I guess, in the whole rescue effort, right?
Each station had what they called a keeper, and Robert Pierce was the keeper of station number 40, and he was a son of a Wampanoag Indian. He was born a few years after the end of the Civil War, so this is a gentleman from another era, and he wanted to make his living off the sea, and he wasn't sure if he was going to go into the commercial merchant industry, if he was going to be a lifesaver, but he ended up going the life-saving route. And By July 21st, 1918, he found himself the keeper of station number 40, and it was him who called at around 10:40 that morning. He called the Chatham Naval Air Station because
the I wanted to talk about that in a second, but yeah, that and they got those folks on the line, so to speak,
right.
And in action. But just backing up for a second about these life-saving, for those of anyone who may not know, this was a whole network of these life-saving stations that was, this was the precursor to the Coast Guard. And these guys were really hardy. They would walk the beach, right, at night, any weather.
Day and night.
Just sort of looking for people who may have come off wrecks. And they, didn't they also have a network of small shacks that they erected?
Yeah, it started out, the life-saving service, it started out with shacks along the beach, but they eventually grew into these stations. So they were actually manned by lifesavers by 1918.
And they would drill constantly about going out on the boats and
Yeah, it was a precarious job. I mean, imagine, oftentimes when ships are in distress in nasty weather, it's not during the nice months of summer. It's often during the winter months. And you can imagine going in a, rowboat and rowing out in a, a gale when there's ice on the water and ships
are
sinking.
It's hard to imagine that. It really is.
And their motto was, you have to go, but you don't have to come back.
Right, right. And many of them did not. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so So he calls up this Chatham Naval Air Station, and again, for people who may not know, and a lot of people probably don't, this is another piece of Cape Cod history with really very few reminders today of its existence. I think there was as you said before we started recording here, there's a small ramp that you can see from the air, and I think there's also a very small plaque at a town landing in North Chatham just sort of saying here was the spot of the Naval Air Station. But beyond that, there's really nothing at all that would give you the indication that this was there. But it was a big Naval Air Station that was constructed in Chatham in World War I for the part of the defense of the East Coast of the U.S. And Eric Lingard was a pilot assigned to the station, and he had a key role in the events of that day. So tell us a bit about what he and who he was and what he did that day.
Eric Lingard was a Massachusetts local. He grew up in Gloucester, specifically the village of Annisquam.
Okay.
And he entered the war. He wanted to do something for his country. And like other pilots of his day, he assumed he would be stationed in, overseas in France to fight Red Barons above the Western Front.
These guys wanted action.
Yeah, they wanted action. Yeah. But because he knew the coast and he had he used to play with speedboats, he was assigned stateside, and his orders were, kept pending that he would ever go, onto the other side of the Atlantic.
So Pierce calls him up and says, "We're under attack up here in Orleans. You gotta get out of here quick." And so what happens then?
So Robert Pierce, he picks up the phone. He calls the Chatham Naval Air Station. Unfortunately, regrettably, that call has lost 10 minutes in transmission. It took 10 minutes for the phone call to make its way to the Chatham Naval Air Station. So by 10:50, the executive officer at the air station picks up the phone. He gets a message. By that point, he's already heard the bombardment 7-10 miles away. He knows what's going on, or he surmises what's going on. And he's already issued or ordered all the other planes and pilots into the air. But there was two huge problems at the air station. One was that most of them had been out searching for this lost dirigible, which is essentially a blimp. And two, it was rumored that a lot of the pilots were out playing baseball that Sunday morning against a crew from a minesweeper. So there wasn't a lot of people and planes around.
Right.
But they do have one plane that starts to take off at around 10:50 that morning, but it can't due to a spark plug problem. So it's out. And so you can imagine
like
this.
Murphy's Law.
Yeah, exactly. If you can imagine this executive officer running around trying to find a pilot and a plane and some pilots. And he finally finds one, and it's Eric Lingard. And the plane that he takes off in also has a problem. It's got a bad crankshaft. And it wasn't sure how long the plane would stay in the air. But this doesn't matter, because this is the big show. This is their one chance. This might be the only action they ever have on this side of the Atlantic. So they take to the sky, and within 4 minutes of taking off, they're above Nauset Beach in Orleans.
So Lingard takes off and goes up toward Nauset Beach, as you said. But his plane is carrying these bombs called the Mark IV, I believe, and they were just complete duds. Tell me what happened there. Every one of them failed to detonate, that were dropped. And so,
yeah. So for some reason, the Mark IV bombs, which were the bomb of choice for these planes, they were very complicated, had a very complicated mechanism to to get they were very hard to get ready to drop. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't necessarily the pilot's fault. They did a lot of testing in various other air stations, and they like you mentioned, the bombs that were dropped, they just failed to detonate.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you think the conditions, maybe the salt air or something like that, had something to do with messing up these mechanisms?
I think it was just they were hastily produced. I mean, yeah. We were kind of late in getting to the war, and
So they made these valiant attempts, but sort of the best efforts, it just didn't really, they weren't able to counterattack this sub in any way.
They weren't. However, the sailors aboard the U-156 have no idea that the planes are only carrying one bomb, and they don't know if there's going to be more planes that are coming.
I see.
So I know we can all agree that the planes did hasten the sub's exit.
Right. So the sub just eventually stopped firing after how long was the total? You said it was
the first
minutes?
Shell was around 10:30, and then by 11:30, the planes had sort of done their sorties, and at that point, it was starting. It had submerged, and it had come up one more time, and actually fired at the station number 40 right before it went down one last time.
Wow.
And it submerged, and by 12 noon, it had disappeared. So all told, 90 minutes.
Yeah, to where no one knew, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that was, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, incredible. And then, so we were talking a few minutes ago about these two the two people from the Perth Amboy that were taken to Boston, and they were of Austrian descent, and the press was sort of hounding them for details. And that was we forget that the distance, that 90 miles, was a huge amount of distance because of the difficulty of travel and that sort of thing. And there were a lot of these wild rumors and speculation flying around about the event. But there was one guy, a doctor from Boston, who was vacationing in the area, I guess, right in a beach house or somewhere, and he managed to contact the Globe and gave a surprisingly accurate, kind of almost a running, like a live blog, the equivalent would be today. And tell us a little bit about who he was and what role he played that day.
Yeah, his name was J. Danforth Taylor, and he was one of the affluent people of the community in Nauset Heights, and he had a house above the beach in the bluff. And just before 11, he called the Boston Globe and began to relay this, blow-by-blow scoop to the paper. It was his favorite paper. And, you can imagine what the newsman on the other end of the line, said. And, does he even believe him? But the Boston Globe got a scoop article because of that.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And they sent him a box of Corona cigars as a show of thanks.
Wow.
After.
It's unbelievable. And so how did the other papers and the press in general treat the story? Was it as fantastical as everyone's?
And more so. It was very sensationalized. Yeah. There was a lot of inaccuracies in those early reports, as you can imagine. They were eager to dig up, juicy gossip and,
sure,
paint the German as, this terrible Hun who was coming back to rape villages and,
right,
burn towns, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So now what was after this had happened and after the proverbial dust settled a little bit, clearly the military must have been kind of beside themselves in a way. What was the offshoot in terms of their reaction to it, whether public or not? How did they try to counteract this going forward?
Well, these air stations that cost millions of dollars of the taxpayers' money to build, and they were built specifically to combat German submarines, and of course it failed at that task. So what they did was they sort of painted the Germans as clowns for, attacking a seemingly worthless object like a tugboat. Four barges.
Yeah. Wow. And so that's
all they could do.
That's all they could do, right, was just sort of do the publicity offensive, right?
Yeah. And they worked at improving the Mark IV bombs. They sent more planes to the air station. They sent more bombs to the air station. Eventually, the planes were equipped with a Davis gun, which was mounted on the front of the plane, which did, it wasn't as, strong and powerful as a Mark IV, but it was reliable, and mm-hmm, it could have done some damage to a U-boat.
But this was really the only time, or correct me if I'm wrong, but I should say, was this the only time that the Chatham Naval Air Station had occasion to counterattack a U-boat or anything like this?
There were plenty of false alarms in the summer of 1918 and into the fall of 1918. but mm-hmm. this is the only time they had the, you know, the chance to actually attack.
And then what was the eventual fate of the air station? We all know it closed down, but how long after the attack did it stay?
In the early, I think it was 1920 or 1922, it was eventually shut down. And then the base was sold off. You know, they sold the buildings. They auctioned all the stuff that was in the buildings off, pieces of the hangar.
Was it just deemed to be no longer strategic? Or
yeah, the U.S. Navy was downsizing in the interwar years. And, you know, there were things all across the country they were doing this to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so... Again, it's an incredible story. So it's over now, and the U-156. Tell me what happened to it after the attack on Orleans. It must have gone back to Germany, right? And what was its ultimate fate?
Well, actually, the U-156, it kept going. It kept attacking. So it took it went north and started traveling up the outer arm of the Cape, and eventually towards Nova Scotia. And it kept harassing Allied and neutral ships, sinking some. Allowing some of the sailors to, you know, get in rowboat or lifeboats and go to shore, but they killed Allied and neutral sailors, you know, who were just doing their job, and eventually it had to beeline its way back to Germany.
Mm-hmm. How were these things powered? These U-boats to make these incredibly long journeys across the ocean.
I believe they could charge their battery when they were above the water, and they used a diesel engine when they're underneath. But typically, the vessels, they traveled above water. They only kind of went underwater when they needed to.
Uh-huh. Now, Jake, as I said earlier when we first started talking, this is, for whatever reason, I think it's safe to say it's a fairly lesser-known historical story here on the Cape. And I'm wondering why that is. Does Orleans... Do they have artifacts in the Historical Society, or is it publicized more in around Orleans, or what?
It is and it isn't. I don't think a lot of people know about it. I kind of was, you know, in 1920, I would surmise maybe 10 out of 10 people knew about the attack on Orleans. By 1950, maybe only 5 out of 10 did. And by 2000, 2010, probably only 1 or 2 did. I just think it's a story that's lost to history. I think the people who told the story are, you know, they're, you know, long in tooth, they're old, and they're not telling the stories anymore. And this is just one of those stories that's been lost to history. And the Orleans Historical Society does have a couple of artifacts. You can find a couple of things from the attack. And just recently I saw a piece of shrapnel being sold on eBay from the attack on Orleans. So there's
always things, ends up on eBay,
yeah,
right?
There's stuff still out there. But there's not a monument per se. There's a marker, but ironically, it's on a private stairwell. So it's just not, and it says, you know, 3 miles from here off the coast, the German U-boat, you know, attacked and some of the shells hit, you know, the mainland. But it's not a private stairwell and it's not well advertised. And it's just, it's a big question. Why doesn't anyone know?
Yeah. Now, what got you interested in this story to the point where you wanted to write a book about it?
Well, I'm a history geek, and I love World War One, and I just always thought it didn't get its the proper attention. We know plenty about World War Two, but not that much about World War One. Mm-hmm. So I've always been a student of World War One, and for a living, I tell stories. I'm a television producer, and I tell through a different medium. And I'd always heard I always knew about this, and I'd start doing some research, and it was the story was bigger than I thought. There was a lot more to it. I when I learned that there were seaplanes that attacked, I thought that was very interesting because I had no idea that there was an air station there. Mm-hmm. And Heroes kind of came out of the story, and Eric Winger, I dedicated the book to him. I just thought he was somebody who was lost to history.
It's incredible, really. Are you doing any sort of speaking engagements to promote the book here? Or
yeah, I'm on a Cape Cod book tour, so I'm here just doing a bunch of, you know, I've slammed a bunch of book things into a couple of days, so I'm just traveling around and doing some book signings and some lectures and
great
interviews with NPR.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad we could help, and certainly a fascinating story. Jake Klim is the author of the new book called Attack on Orleans, the World War I Submarine Raid on Cape Cod. It tells the story, the largely forgotten story of the day in 1918 when a German submarine attacked a tugboat and four barges off the coast of Nauset Beach in Orleans. So, Jake, I really appreciate you being here. It's a fascinating story, and thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
I'm Brian Morris, and thanks to all of you for listening.